Is everybody in? Is everybody in? The show is about to begin.
Hey guys, welcome to another episode of Concerts That Made Us. Before we jump into this week's episode, please rate and review us on iTunes, it really helps the show grow, and subscribe to us on your favourite podcast player of choice. You can find us on all social media at Concerts That Made Us Podcast, and be sure to check out our website at www.concertsthatmadeus.com. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so by signing up at patreon.com/concertsthatmadeus, and you'll get access to exclusive features such as video versions of the podcast, early access to episodes, knowledge of upcoming guests, and the chance to ask a guest a question, and much, much more. Now this week's episode. Following on from the hugely entertaining episode we did with Jack from Bad Counsel, I now have Greg from Bad Counsel on. So you know you're in for a good time. Also, be sure to listen right till the end. We have a very special treat. We have the new single by the great Wax Mechanics. You'll remember Wax from season 1. Well, he's got a new record out and it's absolutely fantastic. I can't wait for you to hear it. So, without further ado, let's get on with the show. Hey Greg, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you, sir. It's great to be here, man. Good to see you in person.
You too. You too. It's great to have another bad counselor on the show.
It's our pleasure.
So for the listeners that didn't hear Jack, although I'm fairly sure there's probably none, would you like to tell them a bit about your podcast?
Yeah, we are. We're Bad Counsel. We are an advice show that's really disguising an improv comedy show. So it's Tim, Jack, and I. We did a previous podcast together and then started this one. And my lovely wife was usually at my side listening. And then she just worked her way onto the show. You know, her laugh is irrepressible and her opinions and her voice are great. So we brought her on too. And we take voicemails and emails and direct messages from fans asking us absurd questions, and we try to give them equally absurd answers.
It's definitely hilarious, that's for sure. And it's cool that you have Katie on the show now to kind of even it out, to give the female perspective.
Not just give the female perspective, but, you know, she gives Jack and I permission to take things even further than we normally might. Yeah, you know, we do have a fair amount of female listeners, and having Katie on the show, she's like our barometer. So we know we haven't gone too far if she's laughing. So no one can accuse us of being totally out there. We can say, well, you know what? Katie's on the show and she finds it funny. So lighten up.
True, true. And I can't proceed without asking you, what's your favorite piece of advice that you've given out, if you can pick one out?
Oh my gosh. I'm big on revenge, you know, situations.
Right.
And so, you know, I'd have to think about it, but you know, I've given a lot of advice that I'm proud of. I think on a recent episode, we advised a guy who was afraid his best friend was going to steal his girlfriend to start a rumor about him having venereal disease, you know. You know, first I thought we'd actually arrange for him to get a venereal disease. And then Katie, the voice of reason, popped in and said, you know, you could just say that he had the venereal disease. And I was like, yeah, that'd probably be a lot easier.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's what comes to mind. So, you know, you have to, I'm proud of all the advice that we give. So it's hard to kind of zero in on it.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing that comes across really well is, how quick-witted you are, and your delivery is always on point. It just flies off the tongue, you know?
Well, I appreciate that. It's very kind of you to say. You know, I definitely take pride in trying to be funny. You know, it's from growing up in a big, I grew up in a big Irish Catholic family here in the U.S. And, you know, if you weren't quick-witted and you weren't ready to come with some something clever, then you didn't last very long in my household. Like, sarcasm was the language of the house.
Yeah, that's definitely the Irish thing coming out in you, all right? Mm. You've actually been to Ireland before, haven't you?
I have, yeah. In the 90s, you know, a friend of mine, also an Irish friend from the same parish where we grew up, he had some family over in Ireland. And so we went on a trip for about 3 weeks all over the Republic. You know, we flew into Shannon, spent some time there. His family actually has one of the most, classic to the original thatched roof cottages.
Oh man.
And a little village outside of Spittal.
Mm-hmm.
Am I saying that right? Outside of Galway, in a little village called Wormhole of all
Wormhole.
Places.
Wormhole.
Yeah. And it was just, it's a little thatched roof cottage with like ponies living in the yard. At least it was at that time, you know, concrete slab floors.
Mm-hmm.
It was the place we stayed for the first couple of nights. It was super, super cool. My friend's cousins took us to this pub that was literally in the middle of nowhere. I mean, utter darkness. It looked like a split level house from the suburbs. And then you walked into the basement. It was just jam packed with people with, you know, live music. Mm-hmm. We weren't strangers at all. Everyone welcomed us like the family that we were.
Yeah.
It was really cool.
Sounds like the typical Irish pub.
It was wonderful. Yeah. I mean, it was just cool to be off. I mean, I love the more well-known places too were new for me, but to just kind of be in a neighborhood pub in a small village and just, it was just really cool. Like for me, going to Ireland was like returning to my roots that I didn't even know that I really had. Mm-hmm. You know, I love the melting pot of United States, but to be there and kind of get a feeling of like, you know, this is where my people came from, was a lot more emotional than I anticipated it to be. I thought it was just going to be a one long pub crawl, but it was actually that and more. It was wonderful.
Yeah. So it must have been a great feeling. You mentioned the village called Wormhole. I'll have to look it up, but we have some very interesting village names in Ireland. The county I live in, there's two villages that come to mind. One is called Bastardstown, and right beside it is Whoretown. And not one word of a lie, they are real villages. So we get very inventive with village names over here.
Well, it's interesting. You'd think that if you were naming your neighbor's village, you'd go with something like, you know, Whoretown or Bastardsville.
Yeah.
You know, but to voluntarily adopt that moniker, it's like, okay, yeah. Interesting.
It's probably the Irish sense of humor again.
It is, yeah.
But we'll get on to your music. So,
okay.
How would you describe your music taste?
It's wide ranging for sure. You know, I grew up the youngest of six kids, and they all had you know, their own tastes, and I kind of just soaked it up. And you know, a person of my age, there wasn't the internet, there wasn't even a lot of TV channels, and so the radio and listening to music. In a large family household like that, when you have one television to crowd around, being the youngest, I was never getting to choose what was on TV. So instead, I listened to the radio. And so, you know, I grew up listening to the things that my older siblings liked. So like classic rock, the Beatles, Led Zeppelin, you know, but then I had my sister's influence. And you know, as a small kid, they liked, you know, pop bands and disco even for a time. And so I got exposed to all of that. And it was... To me, it was all good. And, you know, and as I matured and developed my own taste, I definitely maintained that love for, you know, kind of that classic rock and roll. But punk rock really captured my attention when I was a younger person. And, you know, The Clash and then, you know, Southern California punk.
Mm.
Those were the bands that I really became interested in learning. And when I had kind of musical aspirations for a minute, that's what I aspired to be, was like a punk rock guy. But even beyond that, you know, you get connected to rockabilly, you get connected to, you know, old country. And then I like the second, you know, they called it the new wave back in the day, but now I know they call it second wave. But like, you know, the synth bands and prog rock. I liked it all. There was so much good music out there, and it gave me so much, you know, like, company. Like, your music kept me company, and also was just soothing for me and endlessly fascinating. And so I really liked it all. I can't say that I know a lot about jazz or that I find myself reaching for jazz very often. But everything else, you know, including hip hop and rap and EDM and country and the blues and, you know, all of that stuff, even classical, I have some classical composers that I really love. Music has just been the kind of that ever present comfort in my life.
Yeah. Yeah. As a fan of older rock and everything, then what do you think of the music industry nowadays, or music nowadays?
You know, I think it's awesome. There's just I'm endlessly fascinated at the variety and the amount of music that can that people can put out, and I am grateful to shows like yours, to like the larger kind of media world that you get exposed to so many different things. Because just listening to your show, I've discovered so many really interesting acts that have become a part of my regular listening now. It's amazing.
That's good to hear. It's
yeah, for sure.
It's what I kind of aimed at when I wanted to start the podcast, was introduce lesser known acts to new audiences, you know, people that might have never had the chance to listen to.
It was awesome. I was actually, before we started today, about an hour ago, I was on a video call just chatting with the guys from Venikava.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And so we were just chatting. Really good. We've become big fans of theirs.
Yeah, they're a great bunch of guys. Really cool. I'll have to try getting back on the show sometime in the future, catch up and see what they're doing nowadays.
Absolutely.
So what was the first single or album you ever purchased?
Okay, now, so remember, I had older influential sisters, so don't judge me, but probably the first band that I was into was because of my sisters. I will acknowledge them. It was the Monkees.
Okay.
You know, so, you know, that, you know, Davy Jones and the Monkees, those were probably the first 45s, like vinyl 45s were what I could have access to because I had a little record player in my room.
Okay.
So that was among the first things I bought. But then the next band that I really became into, and I started buying their cassettes, I think, was REO Speedwagon.
Oh.
Just kind of like a, I think, are they an American or the Canadian band? I can't remember.
I couldn't tell you, to be honest.
Yeah, but they had a big hit album. And then, you know, those were kind of my precursor bands and the ones that I don't always admit to having loved. But the first band I was really into as an adolescent that I still talk about proudly is Van Halen. They were the next big band for me.
Yeah, yeah. Back to the first one you mentioned, actually, I was really surprised. I was expecting you to say Donny Osmond or something.
they're first cousins musically, I think, right? The Monkees and the Osmonds.
You know? Yeah, yeah. I tend to lean towards the Monkees myself, even though they were hugely manufactured. But
yeah,
there's some really good tunes, though. I've actually got one of their greatest hits CDs somewhere in a box.
Yeah, Davy Jones. I mean, they had that. They captured that manufactured kind of British, you know, style, the Turtles, the Beatles, all of those things. And so they were easy to listen to, that's for sure. And then having the TV show, that just put it over the top for me.
I was just going to mention that you surely watched that as a kid.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, that was my MTV, watching the Monkees.
I often think to myself, I seen it as a kid as well. Obviously, it was reruns, but I always think I must look it up and watch an episode now and see what I think about it. Because I find that there's all these movies and TV shows that I loved as a kid, and I watch them now, and I, you know, I can't get through one episode.
I'm
wondering if they're like that.
Yeah, they don't hold up. I mean, even for me, sadly, I'll admit that that I don't really watch Star Wars anymore.
Really?
You know, Star Wars for me in the 70s, like, that was my religion, you know, and it was like such a profound movie series on me. And then when I've gone back and rewatched them recently, I'm like, you know, all the inherent illogic of, you know, these people living in huts on a desert planet, but having, like, you know, vehicles that travel the speed of light. It was like,
yeah,
it all came crashing down on me.
Yeah. It's just a part of getting older, I suppose.
It is. Yeah.
So the first concert, the very first one now that enlightened you to what a concert actually is, what was it?
It was Boston, the band Boston. Yeah. And so it was Pittsburgh. That's my hometown. And probably around 85, 86. So I would have been like 14, 15 at the time. And my two closest friends, one of who's a regular contributor on Bad Counsel, but those two friends and I, our mom dropped us off in downtown Pittsburgh. It was where the local hockey team played. And, you know, we asked her to drop us off like 20 blocks from the venue because we didn't want to be seen getting out of one of our mom's cars. And me and my friend Brian and my friend Tim, we went and saw Boston. And it was amazing, you know, because it was that pre-concert activity back in the days of people hitting beach balls. And I remember to this day that the pre-concert music they were playing was the White Album. And, you know, and I had only recently gotten really into the Beatles at that age. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. They're blasting the White Album through the arena. And then Boston came on and, you know, they were so good and precise. And so it was just like listening to their records, which was what I wanted at the time. And I just felt like an adult. You know, it wasn't some social activity that my parents had offered up to me. And I said, yeah, that sounds fun. It was something that me and my friends and I had decided we wanted to do. And we went and got the tickets, you know, and we arranged the rides. And that was just something completely independent of my parents, which really made me feel like an adult. And I think just further cemented the love of that experience.
Yeah. They must have been an amazing band to see as your first concert.
They were awesome. I mean, you know, and again, you only heard like the radio cuts and the album versions of things, and they were just so on it, and, you know, and they were like that quintessential like late 70s, early 80s band. So
yeah,
it was a great experience.
Have you seen them since?
I have not. No, they, you know, their lead singer is a bit of a recluse, I guess, you know, and they had that brief resurgence a few years later, and then you don't hear much from them, you know? And so I love them, but I was never really, they were an example of a band that my older siblings loved. And so I really liked, but then as I started to develop, my tastes went into some different directions.
Yeah. Yeah. Was there ever any bands you were into or any music you listened to that your parents frowned on?
No, not really. Cause my parents were, I was the sixth kid of six and by a long shot. Mm. And so they were just like, you know, ready for me to get out of the house. And so I was like, you know what? My dad actually told me you have two rules, Greg, you know, don't get arrested and don't knock any broads up. You know, and that was it. And they literally were my only rules. And you know, knock on wood, I won't say if I broke either of those, I shouldn't say, but no, they didn't frown upon anything. They occasionally worried about me. Like when I would show up with a crazy hairstyle or when I got my ear pierced, my dad freaked out and thought that I must be on drugs. And they were a little bit leery of Dungeons and Dragons when I played it.
Right.
But music, they were kind of like, yeah, whatever, music's music.
Sound pretty cool when it comes to music anyway.
They were, yeah.
The last concert, this will be interesting.
That's a good question. It was pre-COVID, and I'm just making sure that I have this right in my mind. Yeah, Elvis Costello. It was South Florida. He did a theater style show. There's probably 4,000 or 5,000 max capacity. And one of my buddies who lives here in South Florida near me had an extra ticket. His wife decided not to go. And so we went and saw him. It was the first time I'd seen him. And he sounded phenomenally.
Would he have been someone you've always wanted to see? Or was it just because the ticket was available?
No, he absolutely was somebody I've always wanted to see. I love Elvis. And so to get a chance to see him live. And, you know, he played, obviously, his older set list. But he also played some new music, musical that he's working on, and he played some of his stuff from his Burt Bacharach collaboration.
Right.
Which I don't know if you recall that, but it was a real departure for him, but it was good, and I enjoyed it all. You know, he didn't play Every Day I Write the Book, though, and I was kind of like, all right, I'm going to come see Elvis. You could make the effort and play that one song.
Yeah, I hate when bands or performers do that. You know, you're standing there waiting, and at the end of the gig, you're like, right, it's going to be the encore. The encore happens, and it's not there. Like, they have to play their most well-known songs.
I agree. Yeah, I mean, you know, I get it. They may be bored of it, but my God, they got their house on that song, you know.
Exactly. I've heard musicians say that if you're going to be a musician as a job, you don't do it to become like the best guitarist or the best singer ever. Mm. You do it to get good at repeating the same 10 songs over, and they're your most popular ones. You know, you're always going to have to be able to play them ones, and they're what the crowd wants to hear. So you have to include them, you know?
Oh, for sure. And I've heard a lot of artists who do play their most popular songs say, hey, listen, man, you know, I owe so much to the fans who enjoy these songs. And so, you know, you're never going to hear me complain with the life that I've had that's been afforded by my popularity, complaining about playing a song that brings joy to a lot of people. You know,
yeah,
those are the musicians I like to hear.
Yeah, me too. I definitely agree. Little side note, actually, for those that can't see, you're wearing an awesome Led Zeppelin t-shirt tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone that listens to your show will know that you have a collection of concert t-shirts or band t-shirts.
I do.
What's your most prized possession?
It's hard to say. It changes because I do rotate through them. But, you know, I like it when I can find bands that are, you know, relatively obscure shirts. So, like, I have a Mr. Bungle shirt that I recently purchased.
Right.
And, you know, Mike Patton from Faith No More. And so I like that shirt a lot. I have my Smith shirt. Means a lot to me.
Yeah.
You know, I love the Smiths. And then, I have this Bad Religion t-shirt that I got when I lived in Portland, Oregon. I was at a concert of theirs, and it was right before the 2016 election where President Trump was elected.
Hmm.
And it was a side-by-side of Trump and Hillary Clinton. And there was half their faces were revealed to be like aliens, you know, like they live type of reptilian creatures.
Oh, yeah.
and the shirt said, you know, none of the above. And so nice. I got a lot of stops in the streets to compliment me on that shirt by all political persuasions, you know, so.
Nice. Sounds like a cool shirt. And are they all concert t-shirts then, or that you get at concerts, or would you just see one?
Not anymore. Yeah. Now, you know, that's the one nice thing about getting to my age, Brian, is that now I want a pair of fucking sneakers. Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know if we have an advisory warning on the show. When I want to get a pair of sneakers. Okay, good. When I want to get a pair of sneakers, I can buy sneakers now. It's not, I don't have to sweat it. You know, if I want to buy shirts that remind me of what it was like to be a young person again, I'm going to go ahead and indulge in those things. So Amazon is mostly where I get my my concert t-shirts now, but some of them I have to really search for. So.
Yeah, that's a very good piece of advice, actually. Last night, I was looking online, and an ad just seemed to pop up out of nowhere. And it's a callback to a show I did a couple of weeks ago with the guy who's the lead guitarist for Stephen Pearcy.
I love that episode.
Thanks a million. I really enjoyed it. He was a great guy. But
super interesting.
It was a concert ticket for Rat from 1987. Mm. And I was like, it was like $8 or something. I was like, should I buy it? That would be pretty cool to have. But then I was like, I wasn't at the concert. But you know what? I think I'm going to take your advice now. I might look it up and buy it after the show now. You know, who cares if I wasn't there?
Exactly. Those are guilty pleasures, and life's fucking hard enough and too few moments of happiness. So I'm going to be like, yeah, if I want a pair of sneakers, if I want to dress like I'm 22 instead of older, I'm going to, by God, do it. So, and then I have Tim there encouraging me all the time. Cause you know, Tim's like, oh my gosh, what a great t-shirt. So he's like my one person, validation group. So
yeah, he's like the little devil sitting on your shoulder saying, do it,
yeah,
do it.
Exactly. Oh, that's cool, Greg. You know, you're not too old for that.
Oh, is there any artist that you've seen that if somebody knew you and your music style, they would be shocked that you've seen?
Yeah, probably. Because I also have a 17-year-old daughter.
Right.
Who's a huge music fan as well.
Okay.
And she likes a lot of cool music, but I've taken her to see Justin Bieber.
Right.
And so people are usually surprised by that one. But, you know, just even without my daughter, I've seen like a lot of different bands. I saw Salt and Peppa, and I loved them. They were so good. You know, I've seen, I guess those are probably kind of the extremes of the bands I've seen, but, yeah, Justin Bieber, some of the stuff my daughter like I love Lady Gaga. I saw her with my daughter as well.
She is actually pretty cool.
She's an amazing performer, and it was just a really cool crowd to like multi-generations and people just really friendly and just appreciating what she was doing. So, but some people might be surprised. You know, I kind of give off the affect of a punk rocker, you know, with my appearance. And so, you know, when Katie and I are over sitting at the beach and I put on Yacht Rock, you know, we get some sideways looks. So,
yeah, that's actually something that's a fear I've had. I have a 2.5-year-old daughter, and as much as I can't wait to start bringing her to concerts when she's older, I'm afraid of what sort of concert she'll be wanting to go to. So I had a little plan before she was born. I used to get my phone and program a playlist of like Metallica, you know, classic rock right up until, say, the late 90s. Just lay the phone on the belly, play it through. So I'm hoping it sank in and she'll be wanting to go to my type of concerts when she's like 16, 17.
She will be, you know, because you're going to be one of those cool dads like I was one of those cool dads. And, you know, not to say she won't go through the phases like my monkey's phase, you know, where she's influenced by her friends or by her little other media outlets. But like, you know, my daughter Carly, throughout those little phases, she was still enjoying The Who and she was listening to Rush and she was appreciating the Beatles. And so, you know, I could certainly say, you know, indulge in the things that you find interesting. And what was really cool was she's introduced me to so many different artists that she likes that as a result of her influence, I've come to really appreciate. And so it's a beautiful thing to share that love of music with your kid. And, you know, we all have our bad band moments, but our guilty pleasures, but she came through just fine. I'm sure yours will too.
Good. So the worst concert you've ever been to, or worst experience you've had at a concert?
You know, my best and my worst concert experience was the same concert experiences. I went to the Woodstock 94.
Oh, man. Oh, that must have been cool.
It was. It was in so many ways. It was awesome. And just thinking about today's chat that we're having, I kind of reminisced about the lineup and the bands that were there. And it was amazing. But like the conditions and like the price and the runaround that we got, it was like hell on earth. You know, it was super expensive. My brother and two of our friends drove to this place, and you know, you get into the parking lot, and this is pre-cell phone days, and it's like, hey, anyone who brought a tent that you have to stakes into the ground, you can't come in. You can't bring that in. And we were like, well, fucking A, why don't you tell us that to begin with? Because that's what we were planning on. But we were there and we were drunk already. So we were like, all right, let's go. And we'd spent all this money. And then we get there and the gates were all pushed over. Like, you didn't even need to pay to get in there.
Oh, man. Jesus.
And so, you know, again, I'm like, well, fuck it. I mean, we're going to have a lot of fun. It's great. We're young and we're going to have a good time. And then, like, so the first night we sleep out on the ground and it's fine because it's dry. But then the next day, it starts to the torrential downpours in the mud. And so like, you know, we had nowhere to sleep. So like, I literally was on my feet for like 42 straight hours because otherwise you were sitting in a waist deep puddle of mud. And so like, you know, we were walking from, you know, there's a north stage and a south stage, just checking out the different bands, and you're just exhausted. But at the same time, like the energy of being there and some of the bands that we saw, you could really appreciate you know, what you were seeing.
Yeah, I could imagine. It's I don't know. I don't think an experience like that could actually, you know, dampen the the overall experience of a gig like that, Woodstock 94. You know, it's I think if I had been there, in my memory, it'd be the ultimate gig ever.
It was amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. What were some of the highlights when it comes to the bands that played?
Well, that's where I saw Salt and Pepper.
Right.
And that was an absolute highlight. It was really, they were really energetic and fun. I saw Primus there. They were good. Nine Inch Nails was a highlight for me.
Man.
I'm from Pennsylvania, as I mentioned. So the band Live, you know, Lightning Crashes guys, I've always loved them, and they played on the first night. I've loved the Violent Femmes. They were there. You know, Bob Weir was there. Metallica was great. You know, Aerosmith was like 3 a.m. playing, and they were amazing. So, it was just an amazing 3 days, you know? And, it was great. I mean, not an unkind word between anybody. Nobody was stressing about anything. People were sharing the things that they had to share. And, it was cool. It was fun, but it was a fucking mess. And you couldn't quite tell where the porta potties began and like the mud puddles ended, you know what I mean? So you just had to kind of like say, you know what? I'm going to not think about what I'm walking through right now.
Oh, Jesus. No wonder you didn't sleep on the floor. So
what my brother fell asleep the one night, and we woke up the next morning and one of his shoes had been carried away, like in a stream of, he must've taken his shoes off. And he was like, one of my shoes is gone. I was like, yeah, it probably fell into that fast running puddle that's been running through the fairgrounds for the last 2 days. So I had to walk like 5 miles back to our car to get him his extra set of shoes, you know?
Jesus. I would have made him walk himself for losing the shoe.
I tried. He was like, I'm missing a shoe. You're going to make me walk without a shoe? And I was like, all right, son of a bitch. So.
You should have been like, here, I'll make it easier. I'll take the other shoe.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Here's my shoes. We wear the same size.
But you said that Aerosmith played at 3 o'clock in the morning. Did the bands just play 24 hours then, or did
not
they
quite? But like, you know how it is at concerts and set changes and things just got delayed, and there were rain delays too because it was raining.
Yeah,
and so there were delays, and so like Metallica had Aerosmith closed the second night, and Metallica went on right before them. But they'd all kind of been delayed and delayed and delayed. And so Metallica played their full set, and they had like a kind of like a pyrotechnic show afterwards. And then Aerosmith had to wait for that to get all done. And then they came on and they played.
Mm-hmm.
It was incredible.
Is there any band that you've seen when you were younger and you've seen now, or when they were in their later years?
Well, I mean, the band I've seen the most in my life is Rush. I've probably seen them 14, 15 times.
Jeez.
And I started, you know, when I was those first concert days, they were one of my first 2 or 3 concerts, you know, when I was 16-year-old. And then I saw them on their 40th anniversary tour, whenever that, you know, when would that have been, like 2015 or something. And I saw them then, you know, so I saw them kind of just age and still be musically sharp. I mean, Geddy's voice got a little bit weaker over time, but I've seen those guys quite a bit.
That's very impressive. Now, seeing a band that amount of times, what is it that drew you in about Rush?
Well, they you know, they're like the ultimate nerdy suburban kid band. You know, I mean, you think about it, like, it's 3 guys and they, you know, there was, you know, they used to wear kimonos on stage. Like they were like strange guys.
Yeah,
they looked strange even, you know, and then their music is just so kind of, you know, inaccessible to like women, probably would be the word I was searching for there. You know, and Geddy's shrill voice. And they wrote their lyrics about science fiction novels. Like it doesn't get any nerdier than that. Like, and so, they made it seem like, you know what, all these things that I think make me such a dork, they're validating me. You know, these are all cool things. It's their inspiration, in fact. And so liking them, I felt like, you know what? I have some cool older nerds to look up to. And I happened to grow up with a bunch of other suburbanites who felt the same way.
Yeah.
You know, we were all drawn to Rush. And my nerdy friends at high school, my nerdy friends in college, whenever they were within driving distance of where we were, which included at the time like Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, or Cleveland, we were going to go see him.
So. Oh, man. Sounds like a great band to be into and be able to, you know, follow them through their career, but also follow them through the different stages of your life as well. You know, I find songs or bands kind of link in with certain points in your life and will be linked to memories in your own life at different stages, you know?
I agree with that completely. You know, I associate times and sometimes times of the year with certain bands. And when you accidentally come upon one of those songs, it's like, you know, it's not just the memory and the enjoyment of the music. It's like that, what it evokes in your memory. It's a really cool thing about music.
It's a complete callback. Mm-hmm. So, the best experience, I know you said it was Woodstock 94, but what was the best part about Woodstock then?
It was just seeing so many bands, you know, and for me, again, you know, a big narrative in my early life was, it was a blessed life and a good life, but it was pretty boring, you know, suburban kid. Right. And so I never felt like I was a part of anything or even on the fringes of anything historic. And so, you know, being such a great music fan growing up of classic rock, you know, what the original Woodstock was so venerated. So the fact that there was another one coming around when I was like 23, I was like, man, this is cool. I'm going to be part of some historical music event. Like I always kind of envied the people of the original Woodstock. And so that was what made it to be there. It made it so appealing. And to be there with my friends and my brother, and just seeing so many bands that I had either seen before at a smaller venue or had wanted to see, it was just overwhelming, like excitement, you know, like for people who are Disney enthusiasts, but it's like, if Disney's only open once every 25 years,
that's a good analogy. All right.
Yeah.
How do you think it held up compared to the original Woodstock?
Kind
of hard to hold it up to,
kind of hard to compare. I mean, I guess most cases things can't ever be as good as the original, right? Because that was kind of a spontaneous happening that became historic. This was kind of an homage to something historic, but still, you know, the fact that like bands, I think Aerosmith was at both. And I think like Bob Weir was there, and I think, you know, the Dead had been at the original one. So to kind of be a part of that, that link between the original one and this modern one, it was like, it was a really good feeling for me as a music fan to say, you know what, I have these musical principles as a fan, and I believe in supporting bands like this. And I've always admired that thing. And now, I'm going to go make that memory with some of my closest friends. And it was, it was cool in that way.
Yeah. It's you're quite lucky to be able to have that experience as well, I suppose.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah, I mean, we were ready to leave at the end of it, though. We were covered in mud, but we only remember the good parts now.
Mostly. Yeah, it's funny. Whenever I picture festivals in America, I never think that it'll rain. Or, you know, I'm so used to piss and rain over here in Ireland. I always picture like a concert in America being, you know, roasting hot, just the perfect summer's day. But I guess it does absolutely piss rain in parts as well.
Yeah, and the parts that I grew up, for sure. You know, I mean, Pittsburgh has more days of rain and cloud cover than any other place in the United States. You know, more than Seattle, more than Portland. And so, it was rainy a lot. Yeah.
Jeez. Back to the Irish thing, then. You practically grew up in the American Ireland.
I did. Yeah. And then when I moved to Portland, you know, people would ask me about the rain. I'd be like, no, it's like Ireland. It's like, it's ever present. Like I'm used to it. A sunny day is like like a gift from God. But even on the drizzly days, you don't mind as long as it's not raining too hard, you know.
Yeah,
you get used to it.
Exactly. I always say when people ask me what Irish summers are like, well, we get one day of sunshine and then it's gone. That was our summer.
Yeah. But it makes for some beautiful landscapes over there.
Exactly. So we'll move past the concerts now. And okay. If you could be locked in a room with any artist from history for 24 hours, who would it be?
That's an easy one for me. I've commented on your Instagram about it too. Like John Lennon, man, he is, so many artists that I admire, not just musically, but something about his art, something about kind of the way he lived his life and good and bad, the challenges that just kind of deeply resonate with me. And then, you know, and to have been a kid, only kind of discovering him, and to have him like, you know, murdered, you know, it just seems so profound and so unfair to me. And so I would love to spend 24 hours with him. And, you know, I tell Katie now, it's interesting, and I don't think about it a lot, but I'm now older than John Lennon was at his oldest, you know, and that's weird for me to think about. Like, I'm older than John Lennon now in a weird sort of metaphysical way. And so to go and talk to like a 40-year-old or however old he would be in this scenario, John Lennon, would just be, it would just be a really nice thing to just say thanks for all the comfort he's given me and kind of the example he set. And, that would be my ultimate dinner.
Yeah, it'd be great to be able to pick his brains. It'd be a really magical experience, I think. But you touched on something there as well about the thought of being older than John Lennon was. Every time I turn an older age, I always have that thought. Like, I remember the first one, I think it was, I'm older than James Dean. Then it was like Kurt Cobain, Jim Morrison. I think the next one, I think, is like Elvis Presley or something, or probably John Lennon as well. But it's a weird thing. I always think to myself, look at what they accomplished by the time they died. And then when I was younger and I looked at these guys, they seemed so old. I know that's probably a part of, you know, you're younger, everyone that's a few years older seems older. But it's weird, they weren't that old. You know, John Lennon wasn't old by any standard when he died.
And as I've gotten older, I feel like they're older in my mind, even though they've stopped aging, you know? And so, like, you can see Paul McCartney and see clearly he's an older guy. But, like, John Lennon will forever, never be older than 40. And now I have more life experience, but I've lived more years than he has, you know? And that's it's a weird thought.
It is. It really is. And what do you remember where you were when you heard first that he'd been murdered?
I think it was when I got home from school. I don't think it was like December 8th, 1980. So I would have been nine. So like fourth grade. So, you know, there wasn't instantaneous news. The only thing that ever got communicated instantaneously was when President Reagan got shot. They broke into our classrooms and told us, but not for John Lennon. And so it must've been when I got home and the 6 o'clock news on, I'm sure that just was my sisters would have been sad about it. My siblings, but even my parents that was big news. And, so it had to be a day after school.
Yeah. He's one of the few musicians as well that gets the term assassinated instead of, it's like JFK was assassinated. John Lennon was assassinated. You know, especially nowadays, if a musician gets shot, he just got shot or he just got murdered, you know.
Yeah.
It just goes to show how highly regarded he was and how much of a cultural icon he was, you know.
Agreed. Yeah.
But what do you think he'd be doing nowadays if he lived?
I don't know. You know, one of the things I struggle with my love of music is, and God, you know, I guess I'm being super judgmental, is like when artists age and they don't age well,
Right.
You know,
right.
And God love them. They've earned the right to age, whatever, which way they are. But you know, you, I hold them in a way in my mind, and I don't want them to disappoint me.
Mm.
And so, you know, I don't think Phil Collins aged all that well. Like, he started making kind of derivative music, and it was like, not so much. But
yeah,
like Peter Gabriel, who you don't hear about, but he's out doing his, he's still making music. He's just doing it whatever he fancies, and it's not about the charts anymore.
Yeah.
So I hope that Lennon would have kind of erred to that side and kind of, you know, been an elder spokesman for music, but not necessarily been cranking out albums at that age. You know, I think that artists, no matter their caliber, at a certain point, that well runs dry of like that emotion that they're drawing from, that comes from like living a hard life and struggling and facing challenges.
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of artists, not that they don't have challenges as wealthy people, but they're different types of challenges that don't necessarily translate and you know, I can't feel bad for a millionaire who's bored, you know, but
yeah,
but his story of how he came up, like Springsteen, you know, that would fascinate me.
Yeah, I've said it before. Nobody wants to hear a song about why your butler wasn't on time with your drink.
You exactly. Exactly.
But do you remember in the mid-90s, the Beatles kind of, well, the three of them reformed a little bit and released the, what was the name of it?
Something about birds, like fly.
The two songs, Real Love and Like a Bird or something, and they added John's voice in. What did you think of them?
I thought, you know, I love the Beatles. I loved all of them, but I thought that was just the wrong thing to do.
Mm.
You know, it just seemed so unnecessary. You know, I would have been delighted if just the three of them got together and did something new. And they, you know, call yourself the Beatles. You know, John's dead. You know, he didn't leave the band.
Yeah.
But to me, it seemed like an unnecessarily calculated kind of commercial move to like, we're going to, you know, it's like when authors die and their relatives find their last novel and they get somebody to finish it. It's like, God, you know what? Can't you just appreciate, you know, what exists in its current form, even as it's unfinished? I mean, I don't know.
Mm, yeah. Let the fans use their imagination to what
exactly
could have been, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's a very good point. There's one of them songs as well, because I know they got John's voice off an old tape deck he had recorded in his house. And you can kind of tell in parts, it's like the tape was damaged almost, because his voice sounds very wavy almost, you know?
Mm.
It's just, they could have done it if they were hell-bent on doing it, they could have done it a bit better. Like, the word to be of that had all the money in the world, you know?
I would have preferred if they had gotten Julian.
Yeah,
you know, I've never heard Sean sing much, but Julian to me sounds a lot like his dad. You know, I was a fan of Julian's, and, you know, get him to participate. I mean, that would have been, I would have loved that, but just to, you know, to use somebody's disembodied voice just seemed like, I don't know. It's beneath those guys.
Yeah, exactly. That's a very good point, though. That would have, I think it would have been more respectful to John as well, wouldn't it?
For sure. Yeah.
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 And plus, he looks incredibly like John as well. So.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
You know?
I mean, that song of his, Valot, you know, he had a couple of hits that were kind of poppy, but that one song, that first song he wrote, was called Valot.
Mm-hmm.
And he sounded just like his dad in that. And the music, the instrumentation was very kind of Beatles-esque. And I was like, wow, this is great. I mean, I really became a fan of his.
Yeah, yeah. If you could see any performer or band in concert for one night only, who would it be?
Living or dead, or just currently alive?
Yeah, living or dead.
One night only. I think I would go with The Clash.
Right. You know, good choice.
The original lineup.
Okay.
You know, because, you know, just about that experience, something about that experience appeals to me more than even seeing like the Beatles live. The Beatles live would be amazing and I would love the music, but it wouldn't be as visceral as going to like one of the gigs that the Clash played and just feeling like the energy of the audience and the slam dancing or whatever they might have been doing then and seeing the Clash live like that at their like kind of rawest would have been pretty badass.
Yeah, that would have been unreal, actually. That's one that rarely comes up. I don't think it's ever came up before. Mm. I don't think the Clash have even been mentioned in an episode before.
I love the Clash. So underrated.
Yeah, without a doubt. Without a doubt. Were you into the Sex Pistols then, by extension?
I hate the Sex Pistols.
Really?
I really don't like the Sex Pistols. Something about John Lydon. He's like too grating, you know? It almost seems like an act, you know, like, or he's a caricature of a punk rocker.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, dude, you don't have to be shrill all the time. Not, you know, you don't have to say fuck you to every situation. It's like, I get it. You're anti-conformity, but you know, just relax. You don't have to constantly be on attack.
Yeah. Yeah. Whatever about when he was younger, you know, late teens, early 20s, but he's the exact same now. And he's like, in his 60s, you know, and there's no need for it whatsoever.
Well, that's what I mean. It's like it's his shtick.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You know, like every other normal artist evolves. You don't see, you know, you're going to see Anthony Kiedis probably diving off of a stage boom anytime soon.
Yeah.
But John Lydon felt like he had to continue the image that he created 40 years ago. And that's just ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah. And, if there was one song, say they were going to end the set with one song, which song would it be?
Straight to Hell.
Right, right.
Yeah, of combat rock. Something about, you know, I like the blend of like melody with like harder rhythms and stuff. And so something about that song would just be, I think, a great way to kind of close down the show.
Yeah, yeah. It's a great choice. Great choice.
Thanks.
And now on to the final question.
Okay.
If there was a song that had to appear on the soundtrack to your life, what would it be?
That's interesting. I'm going to have to reflect on that. Had to be. Well, the first song that comes to mind, I think, there's a lot of songs that I think, when I listen to them, I think, well, you know, I can really relate to that one, you know, but one that would be good for a movie soundtrack is it's Ramblin' Gamblin' Man by Bob Seger.
Right. Right. Why so? Just that sounds cool, or?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, if you listen to the lyrics, it's a guy who likes to move around a lot. Kind of happy go lucky. There's a line in there that he says, "I'm not good looking, but you know, I'm not shy. I'm not afraid to look a girl in the eye," you know, and it's just kind of his like, you know what? F it kind of attitude.
Yeah.
I've moved around a lot in my life and you know, I've kind of had that laid back F it attitude a lot too. And so I think it would be good for the movie.
Good stuff.
As long as we can get Brad Pitt to play the me that I am now, that would be necessary.
Of course.
Yeah.
It has to be done. Well, before we say goodbye, do you want to plug your show, tell everyone where they can find us? And
yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's Bad Counsel. We're on all the podcast platforms that you find great podcasts on. We're on Instagram at bad.counsel. We record every week, new Wednesday. Every Wednesday, there's a new episode. We'd love to take a question, or if not, give us a listen. And if you listen on iTunes or Apple Podcasts and you can still figure out how to do it, follow us and give us a rating.
Great stuff. Well, Greg, it's been an absolute pleasure. I'm delighted we finally got to talk face to face and chat about music.
That's a delight. Thank you, man. You have a great show, Brian. I really appreciate it, and I'm honored that you asked me to be on.
Thanks a million. I was delighted to have you. Hey guys, I really hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, rate and review us on iTunes. Really helps the show grow. You can find us on social media at Concerts That Made Us Podcast, and be sure to check out our website at www.concertsthatmadeus.com.
And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so by signing up at patreon.com/concertsthatmadeus. We've got 3 tiers available. If that's something you're interested in, you'll get access to a private Discord, exclusive uncut video versions of the podcast, early access to ad-free versions of the episodes, and much, much more. So, until next time, keep rocking.
See you next time. We'll be here.